Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby.
Hello and welcome to Movies vs. Capitalism, an anti-capitalist movie podcast. I'm Frank Capello.
And I'm Rivka Rivera. Hey, Frank, how you feeling?
Oh, I'm feeling a lot better. Thank you so much. Yes, I had COVID last week. Thank you for holding down the fort and doing the intro up top. I really enjoyed your little take on the Met Gala. I thought that was right on.
Thank you.
But yeah, feeling better, had COVID. You know what? Second time COVID still knocked the shit out of me. Because I'd heard a couple people who had gotten it a second, third time, and they're like, yeah, it wasn't as bad, just a little tired. Nope, me in bed all day on a Saturday with fever and chills, just like in a fever dream.
Yeah, it's fucking brutal. Well, Frank, speaking of the Met Gala, turns out I wasn't the only one who was disgusted.
Oh, yeah.
Many, many people were, and there was... there was some really interesting creative and great organizing that happened, that people took that anger and let it fuel them into action. And one of those things we want to talk about today, if you haven't heard about this, I guess you could call it online organizing. It's a movement. Block Party.
A digital campaign.
Block Party 2024. This is a campaign that there's a call to action for people to get online and block celebrities who, not limited to, but again, it was in backlash to what happened at the Met Gala and the like grotesque displays of wealth and just no acknowledgement of what's happening in Gaza and just the celebrity culture of just disassociation.
And there were protesters, and there were pro-Palestine protesters at the Met Gala. So anyone who attended the Met Gala had to walk past a horde of protesters, completely dissociate from the horrors of a genocide that our country is enabling, and then walk right into this lavish party where they each paid $75,000 a ticket. So yeah, complete disconnect, complete dissociation.
Yeah. So the call to action here is get on your social media and block these celebrities. They're calling it the Celebrity Block Party. And as a result, the idea being that a lot of these celebrities, a lot of these influencers depend on your following of them, your presence to advertise to you, and therefore to keep their celebrity up and keep their influence up. Because again, a lot of the celebrity culture is tied to how they can be used as human advertisements, right? We're not talking about it. This doesn't even have to do with like, do you like the art or the work that they're doing? This is directly related to how they're being used to advertise to you because of their platforms and make money from you and quote unquote influence. And this trend was started from a TikToker right after the Met Gala with the name Blockout 2024, who posted a video from the Met Gala and then in contrast with the genocide in Gaza and urging viewers to, like I said, stop following celebrities, start blocking them. And they stated in this video, when we hate on them, they make money. When we praise them, they make money. But when we block their social media accounts and completely forget their names, they lose it all. And this picked up. I mean, this has been, if you're online, I guess, particularly on the left, you've been seeing this happening. I had some questions. I had to ask Frank, my more tech-savvy friend, about like the specifics because I wasn't sure what I was like, well, if I'm not following them, how do, like, is that a block is different than an unfollow? Will you specify this, Frank, for others who were might be concerned?
Sure. I mean, I don't know a ton about this but from my limited understanding. Yeah, you can unfollow a celebrity, but you still remain in the pool of users that their account could potentially advertise to, because, you know, as we've seen on, you know, Instagram, Twitter now, it's not, you don't just see the accounts that you follow now. Now you will get advertised accounts. So blocking a celebrity essentially removes you from the pool of people that they can advertise to. So it somehow cuts into the advertising revenue that they can receive.
Yeah,
I
saw some marketer who was sure like did a TikTok showing the behind the scenes. And, you know, I didn't take enough time to really investigate the accuracy of this, but it looked like on the back end when you're like work, because these celebrities are not doing it themselves, right? They have teams who are doing their social media for them.
Sure.
Yeah. And go in and input all the things to be like, this is the audience we want to reach out to this. And so when you go in to do that, if people are blocking you, that limits, like, it just like limits the amount of people that you can, yeah, sell to. Mm-hmm. And so that is a concerning thing for capital to a certain extent, you know. And I think you and I were talking about it's not yet easy to see like the total impact, but we were kind of having, and we want to share with you all, like a little bit of a debate discussion about the intention of this kind of campaign. And like, I think it has, there's contradictions inherent inside of it.
Yeah. The intentions and the effectiveness, what it actually accomplishes.
Yeah. And I think we're not going to do our whole, like, we could go into this for like hours upon hours, but we're going to try and truncate it for you. We kind of boiled it down to like, there's two ways of looking at this. And I think there's been discourse around both. One is like the idea that also by blocking, you're affecting revenue stream, but you're also saying you're like blocking out celebrity culture and the idea of idolizing celebrity and just what glorification of celebrity has become in our society, that they're the cultural workers. And so mm-hmm. we're just kind of, by blocking it out, like my analogy that I think I used, I don't know if it's useful, but it's like a toxic ex. You're just like, actually, wait, I'm done. Like, I'm done trying to make you see it the right way. That's not how, I'm not going to like change your mind. And I think the other element of this is also the acknowledgement that celebrities still do hold so much power and influence that if we can use this as a tool to get them to change their mind or maybe see the right way, then they can use their power and influence for good. And those are two really interesting, they're kind of paradoxical, but they're both useful. And so it's an interesting contradiction that's occurring right now. But it seems like the action is still the same, like block. I don't see why anyone would be like, well, don't block. I've seen people say that, but I think if you want to block, block.
Yeah. Block away. Absolutely. I completely agree that, you know, putting up a wall between yourself and the influence of celebrity culture is like a good and healthy thing that we should be moving towards as a society, for sure. But I also hear the other side of the argument that, you know, we want to push these celebrities to use their platforms in a constructive way, in a way that actually moves the needle. Yeah, there's been a lot of critiques from folks on the left. I've seen some takes that are like, this ain't it, y'all. This ain't the strategy. This ain't the tactic. This ain't going to do anything. Don't rely on celebrities. I hear some of that. I mean, I think the most compelling take that I heard that was critical of this movement was, you know, if we are doing this to push celebrities to use their platform to do and say the right thing, then we have to leave space for them to do that. And blocking kind of maybe just cuts them off entirely. So if, like, if we want someone to use that, like, we have to leave space. We talk about call-in culture. If we call someone in and then they are like, oh, you're right, I should be speaking out about this, and then they do, then we should leave space for that, because that is the intended outcome. That is what we want. But other than that, I think it's a great campaign. I've heard it referred to as the digital guillotine, which I personally love. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this is a debate that we have talked about a few times on this show, which is how much should we be relying on celebrities, expecting from celebrities to do and say the right thing, to use their platform? Because, like, I think you and I are of the mindset that, like, individuals should not be our heroes. We should not be looking to individuals to be the standard bearers for a movement. I think we're of the opinion that a movement is made of people, is made of grassroots organizers. It's made of, you know, like working class folks who are actually on the ground doing the work. But, you know, oh, there was this one TikTok, bringing it back. I love how, bringing it back to TikTok. I saw this TikTok.
Boomers, not all boomers, I won't even say that, but like some people's worst nightmare. They're getting their news from TikTok.
Yeah, I saw this TikTok is the millennial and Gen Z version of I read this book, but I saw this TikTok from this woman. She was talking about this idea about whether or not celebrities actually have power. And it started with a video from Lizzo. Lizzo had, you know, posted a video, I don't know how long ago, saying, you know, hey, y'all, we celebrities don't actually have any power or have as much power as you think. And then this woman stitched this video together explaining why that is demonstrably untrue.
Hey, Lizzo, remember me? My name is Kara Rozelle Smith, and in 2022, you invited me, along with 16 other women, to stand up with you at the People's Choice Awards to accept the People's Champion Award. Little refresher, us on stage. Before that, you shared my tribe's GoFundMe, and your influence helped us to raise over $100,000 towards our goal of land back. After People's Choice, I received a lot of opportunities, including but not limited to being asked, along with others, to speak at Harvard. I received multiple brand partnerships, and I gained tens of thousands of followers. But that's not because of your celebrity, right? You know, on some level, I get it. Y'all don't want to speak up because there's a lot more to lose. But when what's to lose is illusory power built off the exploitation of humans in every way, why do you want to keep that? And it doesn't matter if these people live beyond our imaginary borders because they're human. Celebrities do not have all the power, nor do they control everything. But what they do have is the power to persuade masses. What's needed in a movement is numbers. And boycotts are historically successful when a certain percentage of people participate in them. And that is why people are asking those with influence to speak out. At everyone, our voices matter. So stop staying silent on genocide.
So while I do not want to put celebrities on a pedestal or expect anything from them or hang the stakes of a movement on, you know, a celebrity, it is true that their platform is a form of power. It is a tool, at the very least. It is just a giant megaphone, and their cultural influence is significant. So I don't know. It's this thing of like, we don't want to rely on them, but also it'd be nice if they did the right thing and said the right thing. So you're right. It's a massive contradiction.
Yeah, I think it's easier to hope that we can get them all to change their minds and be. I just think that's a more disillusioned point of view. I think, not that I don't believe certain people are capable of being called in, but I think like that kind of calling in takes a radical shift in your own life. It just takes a lot of work. And if we're dependent on them, getting it right this way. Again, we're in a society where we treat celebrities in some ways like politicians. And I don't mean that in the right wing way of like, they should shut the fuck up and act. You know, like, I don't mean that. I want to see you on TV and that's it. Like, I don't mean that. Like, I heard that.
Sing your song, do your dance, but don't you dare talk about politics.
Yeah, I don't mean that. I just mean more like, I don't know. I think through this debate, I'm leaning more towards like, oh, it in my experience, it is like trying to get that person, like, if you could just change your mind and then see things the right way, like, then it'll be okay and we'll all be influenced. But it's like, it's not actually like, this is where capitalism comes in. This is about them making money. They work for advertisers. Like, there's a reason that they're limited, and like, it may not even be reflective of the takes they have. Like, we live in a world where if they speak out, they're losing. They have to be willing to lose some shit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and yeah, yeah.
I just think the business plan of celebrity would have to change dramatically for that to be, for like the call. It's not like, to me, that's still an individualist take of like, oh, the issue is that they're just not thinking the right way or feeling the right way. I don't think we know half the time what people are really thinking or feeling. You know, it takes a certain level of, and we're asking for that bravery, but I also think that's the part where we're like, oh, that's just going to get us so far to depend on that, where it's like this blockout thing is so great because we're like, oh, actually, can I talk to your boss? I'm going to talk with my wallet. I talk to the, you know, because we recognize like, oh, well, shit, like not taking accountability away from them as human beings. But like, you know, a lot of people are like, well, at the Met Gala, they're not paying the $75,000 the designers are. I'm like, yeah, they as humans are going to have to deal with that choice of like walking past. They're going to have to deal with that, you know, when the time comes for them to see whoever they're going to see when they're. The time comes, you know, and they have to deal with their souls. But we can't depend on like trying to be like deal with their souls in that sense. Like, I believe in calling in, but I think that capitalism is like, we're trying to speak. This movement seems to be trying to speak directly to capital, even in the smallest sense, where like that's why the idea of, I would push back on that critique of like, leave room to not block, because that would be like, well, maybe they'll do the right thing and we can let capital move as it does and they can still have our money. You know, it just doesn't, like, that's like, we in some ways have to be very committed to the systemic change. And I like it because it feels in some ways like it's trying to speak to that.
That's such a good point, because you're right. The system as it stands financially incentivizes these celebrities to keep their fucking mouths shut, like you're saying, like, if, you know, to take a stand on something. You're right, they'll lose money, they'll lose jobs, they'll lose sponsorships, whatever. So you're right, to speak out and to get political comes at a financial cost to these celebrities. But you're right in that this movement, it's kind of like a strike in a way. I'm not saying
it's like a divestment. It's our own way to divest. It's like,
or a divestment. Yes, yes. But you're right. It's also, it's playing within the confines of capitalism to hit these celebrities in their wallets, which is, as we know, you know, one of the most effective ways to enact change, at least, you know, when it comes from like an organizing standpoint. Who knows if like how much of effect it'll have on this, on these celebrities. But
yes, yeah, that's the point. I think it's less about the individual celebrity and the fact that it was like, they're like, no, do them all. It wasn't even like, it wasn't like, let's a Taylor Swift block out. It was celebrity block out.
So I'm a big fan of this campaign. I'm excited to see whatever kind of long-term effects it has. I've already seen some posts, although we couldn't find numbers, that, you know, the Kardashians, Taylor Swift, et cetera, have lost like millions of followers in the last week or so. So if that's true, fucking great.
And even if it's like a drop in the bucket, I think it's a sign that people are getting excited by this type of organizing, of like that they're waking up to like, wait a minute, how can we do more things that affect the money and it isn't just begging these individuals to change their minds. I think people are like, oh, you know, that's not gonna work. That's kind of a crazy, it's gonna make us crazy to try and argue with crazy.
Yeah, to just shout into the ether until the ruling class does what we want. All right, well, we'll keep an eye on this and see how it develops. Maybe we'll end up talking about it again in the future. But let's get to our conversation for today about Margin Call. But before we do, I just want to remind our audience and maybe any new listeners that we do not sell ads on this show. Movies vs. Capitalism donates our ad space to leftist or progressive organizations. So instead, we rely completely on community support to keep the show going. And you can support us by subscribing to our Patreon.
For just $5 a month, you get access to new bonus episodes and our entire back catalog. Our Patreon link is in the episode description in your podcast player, or you can find it at mvcpod.com. And make sure to rate and review and subscribe to this podcast on your podcast player so you don't miss new episodes.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with our conversation about Margin Call with David Bruin.
Hey, everyone. We know that the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is at the forefront of everyone's minds right now. So we wanted to take a moment and share some resources with our listeners on how you can help.
You can go to ceasefiretoday.com, which has a list of resources for actions to demand a ceasefire from our congresspeople. You can send them mass emails, you can sign a petition, you can find a protest, you can phone bank. They have a call script that will allow you to easily call all of your congresspeople. Again, that is ceasefiretoday.com.
And remember, the only way forward is addressing the root causes of violence, Israeli military occupation, and apartheid, and ending U.S. complicity in this oppression.
I know it feels like this crisis is really insurmountable right now, but the more we call our congresspeople, the more we show up at marches, the more we do anything and everything, will help. So keep at it. If we all do this together, we can actually move the needle. Love you all. Solidarity. And stay safe. All right, today we are joined by David Bruin. David is the executive artistic director of Celebration Barn, a center dedicated to physical theater and performance in Western Maine. He is the co-editor of A Moment on the Clock of the World, published by Haymarket Books, and he teaches courses in theater studies at NYU's Tisch School of Arts. Goddamn, David, very impressive and very nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Well, you haven't had to sit through one of my classes, so it sounds maybe more impressive than it is in real life.
Are you just admitting to being like a boring teacher?
No, I don't think I'm a boring teacher. I try to teach with rigor and with some sense of generosity and with as little discipline as possible. But I don't think boring is necessarily my trademark. So,
okay. So just a rigorous teacher.
That is the goal.
And so, David, you and I met in this capitalist reading group for theater workers that we've had a few guests on from this group. And you're actually the first guest on since we've finished reading Capital. So Yes,
it was an amazing experience. We can maybe talk more about this at the end, but the reading group has been great. Alex was incredible talking about Little Shop of Horrors, and I just started Kate's episode on Princess Mononoke. Did I get that, all those vowels correct? It's been a real pleasure, and learning about this podcast has been one of those pleasures in the group. But as Alex said, highly recommend anyone take it on with others. So going it alone is a little daunting. And we can talk a little about some of Marx's terms as it relates to our subject today, if that's of interest.
Oh, that's of a lot of interest.
A lot of interest. But first, David, I'm curious. I'd love to learn more about Celebration Barn, because I'm very impressed when people are producing real theater out in the real world, as it is, you know, more and more seems to be an art form that we don't have as much access to. So tell us a little bit about the work you're doing with Celebration Barn.
Sure. This will be my third summer there, and we're a summer theater located in Maine. And primarily what we do is offer week-long workshops in various kinds of physical theater and experimental theater devising and performance. And so students will come from all across the country, primarily major urban areas, and will arrive on Sunday. They'll train with a very capable, very exciting instructor Monday through Friday, and then they'll depart on Saturday. So we get a lot of people at the beginning of their professional career, or they're trying to maybe transition from a circus performer to a clown if they're in the kind of Cirque du Soleil performance world. There's a high emphasis on people making their own work, being the authors in performance, and it's just a really great place to hone your craft and connect with others. And then we do shows for the local community on Saturday, kind of one-night gigs, everything from variety shows, circus performances, juggling plus confessional monologue, some dance, and then some music. So it's about an hour northwest of Portland. I like to just qualify that I appreciate the name and the rich history. It's not mine, and I wrestled with it for a long time because it does sound like a wedding venue that only allows certain types of cake, but it is a really lovely and special place. So that is not also immune from the contradictions of running a nonprofit in, you know, the current political economic situation. So
sure.
Well, let's jump into this movie because there's going to be so much to talk about in here, and I'm really excited to unpack it. It was my first time watching it. We all watched Margin Call from 2011.
Hell yeah.
Written and directed by J.C. Chandor, starring Zachary Quinto, Kevin Spacey, Stanley Tucci, Jeremy Irons, Paul Bettany, Penn Badgley, Simon Baker, and Demi Moore. And a few others, but I think it's truly, it's quite an ensemble piece. So I named
very generous to say Penn Badgley stars in this movie.
Wow.
He's got a great haircut in it, you know.
He looks good, but
he's coming in hot.
I've got thoughts about Seth, okay?
Wow. Okay, we'll get into it. So the box office for this film, it was made for $3.5 million, and it's brought in approximately $19.5 million worldwide. So, not bad.
Not bad.
Margin Call is a financial thriller set during the initial stages of the 2008 financial crisis, focusing on a 24-hour period at an investment bank. After an analysis uncovers information that threatens the firm's stability, senior executives face moral and financial dilemmas as they decide whether to save themselves or risk greater market turmoil. The film explores the ethical challenges of those at the heart of the financial collapse.
Yeah, it was really tough on all of those finance people. David, a little bit of historical context for when this film was released. It was released on January 25th, 2011, so only a few years after the financial crisis. So here's what's going on in 2011. After facing continued questions about whether he was born in Hawaii, President Obama released a copy of his birth certificate that confirmed he was born in a Honolulu hospital in 1961. Osama bin Laden was killed by American soldiers in Pakistan in 2011. Borders, the bookstore, filed for bankruptcy. Google Plus was launched. Chromebooks went on sale for the first time, and Snapchat was founded. Unemployment averaged at around 9.1%. Inflation was 3.16%, and the retail price for a gallon of gas averaged $3.53. And also, the Occupy Wall Street movement is happening globally. Around the world, protesters marched, listened to speeches, and displayed banners reading anti-corporate slogans, including the now ubiquitous, "We are the 99%, banks are cancer, and tax the rich 1%.
Yep.
I remember it well.
Yeah. It's interesting how when you read the facts, like something as specific as Snapchat was founded just launched me back to like that combined with Osama bin Laden getting killed. I was like, and I'm back in my like white Scion. Right where I was, you know?
I admittedly and ashamedly was not as politically active around this time. So I knew that a lot of this stuff was happening. I knew that Occupy was happening. I knew that the financial crisis had just transpired, but I was very privileged at the time. We just gotten out of college and had just moved to LA. And I was like, oh, I know that there's some turmoil going on, but I think, like, I don't know, it seems like it'll all be okay eventually. Little did we all know.
Were you involved at all at the time during Occupy, David?
No, I went down to Zuccotti Park and kind of observed a couple times. But maybe this is a good segue into how I found this movie.
Yeah, because, please.
And I'll come back to that moment on Occupy and where I was and the nonprofit industrial complex, how it became clear to me. But when I moved to New York in 2009, that was, you know, the immediate aftermath of the financial crisis, which one of those major points might be September 15th, 2008, when Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. And then, of course, over the next 5-6 weeks, there were various relief programs enacted by the Treasury and other parts of the government to stabilize the capital markets and credit markets at the very least. As Frank said, or kind of alluded to, there was a lot of pain for homeowners and other people that continued. And when I got to New York, I was really struggling to find a job. And I had an internship at a company called Signature Theater, a nonprofit in New York, which thankfully ended up hiring me. But before they hired me full time, I was also working at Barnes & Noble in what used to be the Citigroup building before Citigroup didn't have enough money to keep its name on the building. And I was primarily in the business book section. And at least at the time, if you were a full-time employee at Barnes & Noble, you could take out books that were hardcover. You just had to remove the dust jacket.
Oh,
wow.
And I don't know if that's true. So if somebody's looking for a job, I cannot confirm or deny that's a benefit. And all of these business books started coming out. Probably the most notable one was Andrew Ross Sorkin's Too Big to Fail. Michael Lewis is The Big Short, sorry. Also came out at a different time, House of Cards, Bethany McLean, I believe. And I started reading these, and I was trying to connect what I was reading in the book, and the writing I thought was very good. It did have this kind of thriller quality, this character drama that Margin Call also taps into. And at the same time, I realized that I was making $8 an hour working at Barnes & Noble, and I had a few friends who had had their job offers intact who were making $60,000-$70,000 working at Ernst & Young or, you know, one of the consulting firms. And it just seemed to me that there was a radically different wages with talent that in my own mind was fairly comparable. So that was kind of one of my awakenings in terms of how capitalism worked, how it affected wages, and just how radically different people's outcomes could be given the kind of labor that they perform. And yet, I was very much engrossed by finance. And when I got hired at Signature, I got hired as a fundraiser. And I was doing a lot of research. And of course, any nonprofit in New York is very invested, maybe not actually, but invested in the financial sector because that's where a lot of the philanthropy comes from. And so I felt like from 2009 to 2011, I learned more and more and more about the finance system and at the same time, a leftist critique of that system. And I was admittedly pulled in both directions. And I really think how I got into Margin Call was, I think it was one of the first movies I saw streaming, if I remember correctly. You know, Netflix had kind of emerged. I don't know if they had started doing original programming, but they had brought it out. And what Margin Call does for the viewer, I think, is give you the allure of insider knowledge. And I do think that one of the great pleasures that the capitalist partakes in is this belief that they see what's really happening, that they see how the world works. In Margin Call, there's a monologue by Paul Bettany. He's driving over the Brooklyn Bridge. He's trying to find the person in the risk management department, Stanley Tucci, who they fired earlier that day, and they've not been able to locate. And for various reasons, they find him. He's a risk if he's not back at the office. So he's going. And he tells Penn Badgley, Seth, whose performance I think is actually okay in the film, but in any case, Paul Bettany is...
His performance is totally fine. I thought it was just... I thought he was such a two-dimensional character. And the whole time I was like, someone would have told him to go the fuck home. Someone would have been like, we don't need you here, Seth. You can take off for the night. Those are my only thoughts, but sorry, continue your thought.
No, it's a good interjection. And so, you know, he's kind of along for the ride, and Paul Bettany basically says, like, if you believe... if you want to do this for the rest of your life, you have to believe that you are necessary. He's like, I keep, and he's kind of speaking for the entire financial sector, if you will, here. You know, I've kept my hand on the wheel and I make sure people can get their houses and their nice things. And I take my hand off and everything gets really fucking fair, really fucking fast. And nobody wants that. They say they do, but they don't. And he's basically saying, we understand, you know, we have this occultish knowledge. And there are interesting scenes that turn on certain kinds of access that become increasingly esoteric as you move through the movie. So, you know, the kind of inciting event of the film is Zachary Quinto, who plays a risk management analyst. He realizes, building on work by Stanley Tucci, that this firm is exposed, basically has an existential threat, that if someone were to actually figure out what their assets were worth, they would be insolvent. They would go bank, you know, their stock would go to zero, et cetera, complete confidence loss. But, you know, it goes up the chain in a various series of meetings. And ultimately, the CEO, played by Jeremy Irons, you know, Zachary Quinto basically summarizes the problem. He's saying, look, we have these assets on our book. They're far riskier than any of our models ever predicted. If we don't do something about this, we're going to go down. And Jeremy Irons basically says, you know, my job as a CEO is to understand, is the music slowing? Is the party on? Is it slowing or has the music stopped? And then he has this, you know, grand Jeremy Irons thing. He stands by the window and says, you know, I look out there and I don't hear a sound. And that's the ultimate knowledge in the world of this firm, is that he understands what's really happening in the market to the point that it's like listening to music. I mean, nobody else can possibly understand this. And that, for the viewer, can be very alluring. And in the dramaturgy of it, you know, the way J.C. Chander does the script, they don't talk down to you. You know, there are occasionally set pieces where they're like, explain this to me as a young child or a golden retriever or something like that. You know, as Brian Koppelman
pointed out.
Which
even in that explanation, I was like, not golden, yes. Not my golden retriever. It's like, my golden retriever is a lot dumber than that.
Yes. Does your golden retriever understand what par is or basis points? But and that's also a tactic that really powerful people use sometimes, too. They play stupider than they are. In any case, it doesn't talk down to the viewer, maybe in a way like the film version of Too Big to Fail on HBO does. It lets you kind of catch up, and it makes you feel, you know, it gives you insight into phone conversations and other kinds of things, all these points of access that you have. And honestly, I'm sure the first time I watched this movie, I wasn't like, I'm going to go down to Occupy Wall Street and spend more time there. I was like, oh, hell yes. Like, finance, these people know what's going on. Like, I want to, you know, get on the phone and sell a bunch of toxic assets in 24 hours and potentially make, you know, $1.4 million or whatever. Like, sign me up. I hate to admit that, but, you know, it can have that effect. And I think capitalism and financial capitalism in particular can have that just kind of weird exhilaration. And I think that people who are in the sector do believe that they have some special knowledge. And there's all kinds of ways in which that's not actually true, which we can talk about. But that's really what I think about when I think about this movie, is it's a movie about certain kinds of pleasures and anxiety about knowing, and the power that capitalists feel that they have from those special esoteric kinds of knowledge.
Well, it is true occasionally in that, like, people high up in these extremely powerful finance firms do have access to politicians. They have access to, you know, other members of the ruling class. They have access to people that would give them that insider information, that would give them that inside track on certain things. So it's not like entirely untrue that these people, you know everything, but it's not in the way that I think you're describing, which is there's something special about me where I can just call them as I see them. I have this magical ability to just know where the winds are blowing.
Well, yeah, no, just I love that you referenced, I thought Will Emerson's speech over the Brooklyn Bridge was one of the strongest speeches. I thought there were a few really strong speeches, but I didn't read it that way until you were saying it. And I'm like, that's what it is. It's a whole monologue of him like explaining why he believes this shit and convincing Seth to believe this shit. And it's so well written and it seems complex, but I think at the end of the day, it's the same. We get a similar speech at the end, which is also a brilliant speech. Jeremy Irons, it's just money speech that he gives.
Oh, yeah.
But they're both doing it at different levels, sort of in the in the structure, in the hierarchy of this capitalist system, but they're both sort of just, you're like, in order to stay in this system, you have to have your mantra that you believe. And I think that's something we learned in finishing Capital, is where Marx leaves off, is like, yeah, there's, in order to like believe, there's a lot of myths and storytelling necessary to maintaining capitalism as it exists. And it, under, particularly under Wall Street, I think what part of what Wall Street serves, in addition to just being this big gambling system that is intentionally vague and mythological and hard to understand, like it's like Will is also, we see the role that he plays in making it like this sort of sexy myth that he doesn't really say anything. And the speech is started because Seth says to him, like, shit, this is really going to affect people. Like, real. He's like, yeah, it's going to affect me. He's like, no, real people. And his response to that is, like, you, what you said. And then, like, people want to live. People want to fucking live like this. And they can't live like this without me.
Shit, this is really going to affect people.
Yeah, it's going to affect people like me.
No, real people.
Jesus, Seth. Listen, if you really want to do this with your life, you have to believe you're necessary, and you are. People want to live like this in their cars and their big fucking houses they can't even pay for. Then you're necessary. The only reason that they all get to continue living like kings is because we've got our fingers on the scales in their favor. I take my hand off, when then the whole world gets really fucking fair, really fucking quickly, and nobody actually wants that. They say they do, but they don't. They want what we have to give them, but they also want to, you know, play innocent and pretend they have no idea where it came from. Well, that's more hypocrisy than I'm willing to swallow, so fuck. Fuck normal people. You know, the funny thing is, tomorrow, if all of this goes tits up, they're gonna crucify us for being too reckless. But if we're wrong, and everything gets back on track, well, then the same people are gonna laugh till they piss their pants, because we're gonna look like the biggest pussies God ever let through the door.
He doesn't actually, nothing he says in that speech really makes any sense.
No.
But it's so like this core myth of the haves and the have-nots, and like they fucking need us. It's how it fucking is. So do you want to fucking be a fucking pussy? You want to fucking ride it? Like you want to fuck, you know? And it's like, yeah. I think it's just so easy to be like, yeah, there's money and there's not fucking money. And it's interesting, David, you mentioned like potentially watching this on the first watch and being like, yeah, actually, I'm having a crisis point of like, do I want to be like, do I like this or do I want to rebel against this? And I think I had a similar thought where I was like, I was going to ask, like, do you both think that people's experience of this film depends on their understanding of and expectations of Wall Street as is? Because I do feel like I appreciate how subtle it is. And I think there's a point of view, but it's subtle. But I do think you could watch this and just, I saw a lot of people's versions of this being like, this is how it is. And it actually means that the system sometimes crashes, but can work. And having just finished, you know, being closer to a Marxist, that was not my read of it watching, but I could see how someone could see this film and have a very different take. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, my read coming out of this, and I'm glad you brought all of that up, because I thought the film actually, and the screenplay did a really good job in the nuance of these characters, showing how all of these people are rationalizing this humane system. I felt like there was a lot of those moments of, like you're saying, my mantra, the thing I say to myself to justify this absolutely terrible occupation that I've chosen for my life. You know, there's that scene with Zach Quinto and Penn Badgley in the car early on when they're first trying to go find Tucci, and Zach Quinto looks out the window and it says, all these people out here, they have no idea what's about to happen. And then Penn Badgley has some little bit about like, whatever, dude, I made like $250,000 last year. It's like, I get mine. Sometimes the other guy doesn't get his. That's how it is. And Zach Quinto says, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than that, right? So there are moments like that. Oh, there's that moment in the boardroom when I think it's Kevin Spacey says to Jeremy Irons, like, we're going to sell these people something that we know is valueless. And Jeremy Irons says, no, we are selling at the fair market price. But there are all these moments of people vocalizing something that has rationalized this system to themselves. And to answer your question, Riv, I think it could kind of go in a bunch of different ways. I think someone who has never really engaged with our economic system critically could watch this movie and say, oh, yeah. Yeah, fuck normal people, just like he said. I think some normies could come in and recognize Paul Bettany's character as the slime ball that he is, like a perfectly calibrated slime ball, but still a slime ball. So when he says fuck normal people at the end, you're like, well, that's, this guy's a piece of shit. I don't want to listen to what he's saying. And I felt like they were getting across the severity and the magnitude of the situation enough to, at least for me as the audience, I walked away being like, well, this is a pretty, I think this is an indictment of the financial system and people who choose to go into finance specifically.
I think it depends. There are certain kinds of, you know, perversities that this movie is very compatible with. And I think one of the realities of so much work, especially knowledge work, and this is a movie about knowledge work. Maybe I'm emphasizing that just because of my claim that one of the primary, you know, dramaturgical drivers is people claiming to know things that are otherwise unknowable or difficult or mysterious. So much of administrative work is fairly boring, and I think it can be a great cosplay to imagine yourself in this kind of drama that has a world historical importance. You know, you're calling a meeting at 2 a.m., as ridiculous as that is. You know, is that kind of like when you call a meeting at 5 in your nonprofit administrative office and need to sit someone down about, like, you know, the color or production timeline of some mailer? I mean, I don't know. It's just like when you play pickup basketball. I mean, I don't anymore, but back in the day, you know, you think you're Michael Jordan. You need fantasies to latch on to get through the day-to-day. And that can be one of the beautiful things about films in general. And I think the film leverages that kind of role-playing that people engage in. That's to me, the fundamental contradiction about realism today or in the 21st century is that it's shot through with fantasy. And one of those fantasies is that what you're doing at your desk could have, you know, absolute political, economic, world significance. You know, the other fantasy is that people's hair can look good for a 24-hour period in time. Or if you're a certain kind of white guy, everybody's hair just looks so great throughout the movie. It's something I can never... It's like a stylist touch that I think is, like, very good, but also I become more anxious about as my hairline recedes. But at the same
especially
time...
Especially Simon Baker's really putting everyone to shame with his hair game.
Amazing. It's 2 a.m., you know, in the middle of the night. And for someone that... that can be kind of attractive. You know, I worked for a Broadway film and television producer who is no longer working, who I cannot name because of various legal agreements I have signed.
Sure.
But when I worked there, something that was powerful about it was that you kind of felt like we're invincible, like nothing can stop this train. And so I think, again, that movie gives you that ability. And because it gives you so much access, you feel like you're inside. But I could, there are certainly other people who could watch the film and be completely disgusted. And, you know, there are moments you look at Seth and, you know, he's like 1,000 people. If you went to a certain kind of liberal arts or, you know, very elite undergrad, you've met that guy. And, you know, he went to work for Bain. And that could be, you know, that kind of recognition could be either enjoyable or repulsive, depending on who you are.
It's interesting with Seth's character because I think he played a really pivotal role, and maybe it's that there's thoughts on what Penn Badgley reached. I liked it, but I do think he is the most pivotal scene because this is a world that it's happening so fast. It's this 24-hour thriller. We're so inside of it, day like any other, that suddenly shifts to not. We get the emotion. To me, that was like the emotional lens. He was like the closest to maybe who we would be like not really in on it.
Yeah.
But he's the one who's crying in the bathroom, you know, which I think was like meant to be like was probably that. And then watching Kevin Spacey bury his and then the dog were like the two pieces of this that I could grab some humanity onto, because otherwise it is just it's all money and it feels all fantasy. And I think what's really tricky about Wall Street financial films like this when they happen, like you're saying, just so inside, just so... With how, like, quote-unquote realistic to how it may really be, is that we don't get the contrast of the understanding of the quote-unquote real people being affected and the idea of, like, what a subprime mortgage means, like, what a crash actually means we can feel as alienated to that idea watching it as the people involved do, but without, I think, having some kind of really pivotal wounding moment to represent that alienation, it can actually become too alienating and have the effect I think we're talking about, where you're like, yeah, fuck yeah, then I want to be the one who wins.
Sure.
You know, like
I did think that it was smart Seth's character arc and development. I was giving him shit earlier just because, one, it's Penn Badgley, and two, they really would have sent him home. They really would have, yeah. They really would have said to him, we do not need you here. You can go
home.
Of
all the actors in the movie, you're going to pick on Penn over Kevin Spacey or fucking Paul Bettany?
Kevin Spacey has his own, that's its own thing.
Yeah, that's its own thing. Go, I'm talking about the structure of the movie.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Penn Badgley.
No. It was funny to see him.
It was funny to see him.
This is Gossip Girl era. This is pre-you. So this is like the first wave of Penn Badgley. Just funny seeing him boop around with all of these other actors.
Me?
Oh my God, shut up.
I'm just kidding. I get it. Okay, thank you.
No, but it was very smart that for the first 75% of the movie, he does not care about anyone or anything else. The only thing he's interested in is finding out what everybody else's salaries are. He's that fucking guy in the office who's just like, what do you think this person makes? What do you think this person makes? And he keeps saying things like, you know, I don't, whatever, who cares about the other people? Like, yeah, it'll affect, whatever. But then as soon as he realizes that he is going to be personally affected by this, that's when the emotional, like, walls come down and he breaks down in the bathroom. He's like, wait, this is actually going to affect me? He's like, yeah, you selfish little silly boy. Sorry, you're not immune. So I agree with what you're saying, and I appreciate that they included that in his arc. Because we needed that. We needed to see at least one, whoever the lowest class person is in this movie, which is the Penn Badgley character, actually feel the ramifications of what this crisis is about to be.
Right. But it doesn't, you know, it's like, I think this movie's so great if you are able to access a deep, if this is your only endpoint to what's happening, it feels just like a thriller. But if you, it's really great when you can like contrast like what this actually meant and the gravity and have the context for the crisis actually meant. I thought what it did really, really well, I thought its strongest point was being able to, A, kind of point to how crises like these are inherent to capitalism, even though there's like, and we don't get that until we get to the pinnacle main capitalist played by Jeremy Irons. And so that also, I thought it did an amazing job of showing how the concentration of capital and power and how under capitalism, it like only goes up to like, this was really a 1% movie, because even the people who you think, and I love dramaturgically how we meet everyone in hierarchy. So you start, you know, with the lowest character and everyone's introduced to you, like as the crisis gets worse, the helicopters come in and people are literally coming down from the sky like gods, yeah. Because that's what they are to these people until we finally, so then we get to the Simon Baker character, you know, we get to Kevin Spacey, then, and Demi Moore, Simon Baker, and you're meeting them and you're like, well, who is, everybody has a boss and everyone's a little like, I have a lot of power, but I'm still alienated in like where, like we're like, who is in charge, until we finally get to Jeremy Irons, who's in charge. And it's really important that at the very end, when Kevin Spacey, who plays this character Sam, is like, after selling off all, you know, basically deciding to crash the market, which he didn't really want to do, which I would love maybe to talk about a little, because I wasn't so, I want clarity on the details of that. But we get to him and he gives this speech where he lists basically all of the financial crashes in history and kind of makes this point that, like, you know, money's just made up. There's nothing wrong with what we're doing. Well, he's the one percenter, and that we just react to markets, and there's always been basically winners and losers.
So you think we might have put a few people out of business today? That's all for naught. But you've been doing that every day for almost 40 years, Sam. And if this is all for naught, then so is everything out there. It's just money. It's made up. Pieces of paper with pictures on it so we don't have to kill each other just to get something to eat. It's not wrong. And it's certainly no different today than it's ever been. 1637, 1797, 1819, 37, 57, 84, 1901, 07, 29, 1937, 1974, 1987. Jesus, didn't that fucker fuck me up good? 92, 97, 2000, and whatever we want to call this. It's all just the same thing over and over. We can't help ourselves. And you and I can't control it or stop it or even slow it or even ever so slightly alter it. We just react. And we make a lot of money if we get it right. And we get left by the side of the road if we get it wrong. And there have always been, and there always will be, the same percentage of winners and losers, happy fox and sad sacks, fat cats and starving dogs in this world. Yeah. There may be more of us today than there's ever been, but the percentages, they stay exactly the same.
And it's really amazing. He just kind of gives Bible, and you're like, he is God, and he believes it. And this is, and everything has been concentrated to give him the power and capital that he will be protected while the world falls. And for that 1%, like, that is how the capitalism works. You're like, for this one human being, it probably can be, it is business as usual for these markets to collapse. Like, these crisis points are inevitable, which Mark says, and not out of the ordinary, where it's like the lower you get from him, everyone is sort of reacting like it's unordinary and kind of freaking out. And he, you get the sense, is like been prepared for this and isn't. I think the most he gets upset is like in the bathroom, he has like a sigh. But like, it's really not, you know, it's not like too stress. He like misses a meal, right? He's like, I haven't eaten all day, so now I need my glass of wine. But I thought that was like very strong.
But it is true when he says that money doesn't matter, it is true for him. Like, when you are that wealthy,
it's made up.
Yes, it's made up. It's when you're just talking about moving a decimal point and losing like a few zeros on the end, as opposed to losing your entire savings, losing your pension, losing what little economic security you have, then yeah, then money is made up. It is just fake. It doesn't really matter, because like, what's the difference between 900 million and 1.2 billion? Really not that much.
He's literally close to being like, I manifested this. Like, that was the energy of that monologue, was like, this is my vision board. Welcome.
I think what's great about that scene for me, that at the end between John Tolt, played by Jeremy Irons, and Sam Rogers, played by Kevin Spacey, so As you so beautifully described, Rivka, you know, Jeremy Irons does have this litany of capitalist crisis. You know, he starts out saying, listen, it's just money. It's made up. It's so that we can, you know, trade paper with pictures on it as opposed to killing each other to get something to eat. Also, wonderful that world history for him starts in the 1600s, which is also true of the capitalist. He's like, yep, this has always been true. 16, whatever, you know, no, yeah, farther back, wow, than
no,
that.
Markets, yeah, did not exist before capitalism. Yeah. Never a market, ever.
And then, you know, he gives this thing and Kevin Spacey stands up and he says, okay, John, you know, I'll stay. This is all in the context of him trying to get Sam, who basically runs a kind of fixed income trading floor, who executes, you know, the offloading all these positions during the day, try to get him to stay. And Sam says, okay, you know, I'm going to stay, but not because your little speech, but because I need the money.
Mm.
You know, after all these years, I still need the money. And I think what's great is that both of those things are true. And the relationship between that history and cyclical crisis and this confession of I need the money, that to me, that is like Marx's capital distilled. Both those things, you have to think of those things both at the same time, because you can't have one without the other. And you have one because of the other in some way. And of course, to some extent, like, Sam's line is, you know, bullshit. I mean, he would eat, right? We're not talking about,
sure,
people who are starving. But in his mind, for him, he does need the money.
Well, he just went through that divorce.
Yes. His dog died. I want to talk about the end at some point later, because I this is the one place I have a note on. And I think the other, that scene to me is a cousin to, or resonates with, that earlier scene in the car we're talking about with Ben Badley, Seth, and Zachary Quinto, who plays Peter Sullivan. And Seth basically says, like, listen, you know, this is all gambling. If we weren't doing this, I'd be some guy down at the, you know, racetrack putting it all in number 7.
Right.
And Zachary Quinto says, you do know it's a little more complicated than that. And he's like, yeah, I think both of them are right. Like, to some extent, it is pure, yeah, gambling. It works on that same mental and cultural circuitry. And to some extent, it is rocket science. But it's, both are true.
I think they hinted that many times throughout the film, that paradox. Because, yes, it takes the rocket scientist who Zachary Quinto plays to figure it out. But they're also very worried, because once they realize the rocket scientists put it together, they're still like, oh, well, if you figured this out, anyone can.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So,
oh, yeah,
fuck, we're fucked.
No, I think that's a great moment. It might be Asif Mandi, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He's a general counsel for the firm. You know, he says, it's not going to be long before someone else puts this in and figures it out. And that gives a great sort of urgency to this highly fantastical timeline in which this just happened over a day. You know, in reality, you know, one of the things I think is great about the film as it relates to its historical source material is that clearly there's some model of Lehman Brothers at work here, which is a firm that went bankrupt infamously. And Told sounds a lot like Richard Fold, who was the CEO at Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers also had a female CFO, Erin Callahan, who Fold famously fired, kind of blamed her for various situations. But on the other hand, they do survive the day, you know, and to some extent, there's a certain Goldman air here where they got out first and started offloading these mortgage-backed securities that were basically worthless. And I think maybe we could talk now a little bit, Rivka, about that choice, that decision to sell off these assets. Because I think mechanically what's happening is that, you know, they're holding these liabilities. Basically, they're packaging a bunch of securities together. And the reason that that could be a useful, profitable thing is that, one, they're making interest on those payments. And then when they sell it, they make a bunch of money from the fees. But they also, as Zachary Quinto says, have to hold these mortgages on their books. Well, if there's a bunch of defaults, then these products are basically worthless. They have nothing to sell. So, you know, the market, and they are marking it as these are worth X amount of money, when in reality, they could be worth zero.
And it was because they had automated their system, correct? They had essentially set up something where they were packaging these securities slower than the time it took them to like buy them and actually package them together. And they were just relying so much on like algorithms and models.
Yeah, well, they have, at the core here is they have some leverage, right? So they've got a certain amount of money that they've taken in from depositors and investors. And then they're borrowing against that. They've got all sorts of other obligations, et cetera. And what Zachary Quinto notes is that their models, which are managing their risk, are accounting for certain kinds of variances. So let's say, you know, mortgage defaults go from, I'm making these numbers up, 3% to 4.5. Well, historically, that's, you know, what they're trying to manage. But if they go far outside of that, because they have, you know, less money in the bank than they have loaned out or in the world, they could lose all of that just by a few percentage points, essentially. So in real life, I think The Big Short actually does a very good job of explaining this. If you watch that movie, which I believe directed by Adam McKay, former guest on
Friend of the Pod, yes.
Friend of the Pod, for sure.
That
everyone should listen to the Office Space episode and also Sell Your Shit, which is a great little Easter egg. So basically, rather than hold these assets on the books, they want to sell them as fast as they possibly can, because as soon as the market, you know, nebulously personified, figures out that these aren't actually worth anything, there's going to be confidence, a classic run in the bank, and then they're going to go to zero. So they decide to try to offload all these mortgage-backed securities to other buyers. And of course, in real life, that you could never do that. It would not happen that fast. The other fantasy of this film is that there's no kind of federal, there's no regulatory involvement. They mentioned the feds at one time. And in real life, what happened with Lehman Brothers was the Department of the Treasury, which was run by Henry Paulson, was trying to find a buyer for Lehman. And they actually almost managed to get Barclays, the British bank, to buy Lehman. Wow. But at the last minute, the British government was like, we can't approve this in time. And so when business opened on Monday, that was the end of the story. And then, of course, they did TARP and all these other things. Suffice to say, there is a little bit of, you know, fiction here at work. But I think what it speaks to me, is this contradiction in the service, what's called, you know, the service economy. And ultimately, these are financial services companies. Do they protect themselves or do they protect the client? And Told is basically like, fuck the client. We need to get through tomorrow at any and all costs. And Sam is like, if we don't have the clients, if we don't have people who trust that when we sell them something, it's not a piece of shit, we're going to go down. And Told's like, no, we're not going to go. We're going to survive this. You know, he has that emphatic thing. You know, this is it. This is it.
This is
and
it.
I love that Kevin Spacey's character is like, you keep saying that. What does that even mean? And I'm sure in those of us who have done various kinds of knowledge work about that experience where people keep emphatically repeating something, you're like, wait, what are you talking about? But I think that's really what's core is, you know, they know they're selling something that is has no value. And that's a little bit where the Goldman Sachs of it all is to me, because in the aftermath of the crisis, when there were various congressional hearings, Senator Levin from Michigan was very involved with this. You know, it turned out that Goldman was at one point, you know, buying securities and then selling, you know, one part of their business was saying these things are shit, we need to offload them. And the other part of the business was marketing them to clients. So I think also just to say what's not clear in the film, or a distinction that may be helpful to think about, is that sometimes investment banks are working on behalf of clients, right? They have people, the Saudi sovereign wealth fund or your local college or whoever. But they also are trading for their own books, what's called proprietary trading. So they're trading just to make money. It seems to me that this desk, this floor, is trading just on the firm's account. They're trying to make money for the firm. So they're not actively fucking over their clients, but they are selling something to their counterparties, who are other investment bankers or asset managers, wealth managers, et cetera, that they know has no value. And that, to me, speaks as fundamental contradiction of the capitalist firm as it relates to other stakeholders, is that sometimes you can't reconcile.
That's super clarifying.
And to push it even farther, the contradiction of, for these firms are just within capitalism itself, the whole winner and loser dichotomy. The fact that we accept this system as the best possible system that is built upon competition, where there will inevitably be losers. And the fact that we just all accept that as, that's the best way that we can do it, is that some people just fucking lose all the time. And that means that they lose all their money or their home or their car or whatever. And I appreciated that this movie pushes it to like the 9 millionth degree, where you understand the stakes. You understand how big of a move this, let's call it a margin call, is going to, you know, the impact this is going to have on everybody. Jeremy Irons keeps saying, I do not care. I do not care about how this affects our competitors, our counterparts, our clients, regular fucking people, the U.S. state, the American government. I don't care. As long as we are whole by the end of today, I do not care what else happens. And, you know, from a CEO perspective, if you're looking at this from a capitalist vantage point, he's doing a good job. He's doing a good job as the CEO. I bet the board of directors called him up the next day and they're like, hey, Tolda, you did a great job. Here's another raise. Here's a little bonus, you sweet little British boy. Because he acted within his fiduciary responsibility. His legal responsibility was to make sure that the firm came out up on top. Didn't matter how much destruction it was going to cause. He did, in the capitalist view, he did the quote-unquote right thing, which is fucked up. I'm saying that this is a fucked up thing.
It is interesting. It's that all that is like, yes, it's all fucked up. It's so true. And as you were talking, David, I was thinking about like the timeline of just that this whole movie hinges on this, like getting this algorithm right, that this guy was risk manager was working on it and couldn't quite crack the code. And then Peter comes and cracks it. And then it's just like, yeah, well, this algorithm that is looks on historical events. Mm-hmm. But the whole time you're like, but you're even within that, they're just picking and choosing historical events. The same way that at the end, it's like a clarity on, well, these are the historical events that all crisis happens all the time. You're like, well, if you know that, what do you need an algorithm for? And they don't. Like, it's like a big, it's kind of just like a big, all the busy work that happens for the people inside of it, when ultimately, like, the head capitalist knew the whole time. It didn't even like, you know, it wasn't even like, I said, it was, oh, is it happening today? We knew this was coming. Like, where everyone else seems genuinely a bit surprised, but even the fact that it was like knowledge that had been passed along.
Are you talking about the whole, the Demi Moore stuff at the end where she's saying, I told you and Simon Baker that this was going to happen and you ignored me.
Yeah. Because I think it's like the charades of like, what I liked was that it felt like there was just so much theater internally on Wall Street. Which I kind of thought it was fun for them to play with, like you said before, David, so them being like, tell me like a golden retriever, when you're like, A, I think you probably understand this to some extent, and B, it's not actually, it's like very complicated and not complicated at all because you're just gambling. And they keep alluding to that, like that they're all kind of performing on different levels. And I guess why I enjoyed Sam's character was I felt like Penn Badgley's character, Seth, was like the worst actor of them all. And kind of like got on, like didn't say the right lines, like didn't have a good script, you know, it was just like a little too, but I thought they needed, like everyone had different levels of like how they could play the game, but ultimately I do think a lot of it, and from my slight experience with people on Wall Street, I think I dated someone once who was like ex-Wall. Like, you just get the sense that there's like a lot of just talk. And as an actor, I was like, could I have a new moral code and just like, I could do the talk. Like, it just feels like exciting, I think, for theater people, because we're like, well, we could do the talk. It's improv, you know?
It's so interesting. I know a couple of finance bros now as an adult. And I also have some younger family members who are thinking of getting into finance. There's a very interesting thing that happens, especially here in the US, is this kind of uninterrogated knowledge that people have of, especially young men, I would say, of, I want to get into finance because I want to make money. And they know that that's where the money is to be made. You know, like, that's, if I go do that thing, I will probably be wealthier than most people. And I asked someone, a younger person in my family who said that, like, I don't think I'm going to go into finance. I said, why? They're like, I don't know, I want to make money. That, like, there's nothing else behind it. There's no other motivation. There's no passion. There's no anything. It's just an understanding that if I go do that thing, that I will be, financially secure. And it really doesn't extend too much farther than that, other than maybe, you know, power, status, class, all of those things. But it is it's a very hollow, hollow.
Well, it's literally occupation. What Peter says in that, when they're like, so you're a rocket scientist?
Yes.
And he's like, well, frankly, they're like, why the fuck are you here? He's like, frankly, the money's good. Like, it is funny when everyone acknowledges, like, this is just money.
Yes, but he understands why. You know, like, he at least has some sort of, I feel like he's processed his thoughts about this in that, like, he chose to be a rocket scientist, and then he, you know, said, oh, I can just apply these skills in this other sector and just make a lot more money. I felt like there was
But the why is still innocuous for him.
The why is, yes, you're right. But it's an extremely hollow occupation and an alienating one, and something that Lenin writes a lot about in Imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism, I believe, is he starts writing about financialization, mm-hmm. And this burgeoning finance capital sector that was starting to appear in the late 19th century. And the thing that he points out that stuck with me was, you know, at least with industrial capitalism, the industries actually made something. You know, it was still a terrible, exploitative, violent, oppressive system, but at least there were, you know, at least there was like a factory that made shoes. And at the end of the day, you'd be like, hey, look at all these shoes we made. Whereas finance capital is solely about ownership and just increasing capital. So it has none of the productive benefits that industrial capitalism has. It is just ownership. It's just these massive firms saying, now we own this, and the only thing that we are going to produce is more capital, which is a worthless endeavor in terms of your soul and in terms of doing anything good for humanity. Because, you know, as we know, most of the clients those people service are already the 1%. Paul Bettany's whole speech about, like, you know, the regular guy that I help him buy the house, buy the car, that's not what his business is. His business is making someone who's worth like $3 billion be worth $5 billion. That's what most of their business is. And it's a completely useless, hollow, worthless fucking industry. And anytime I get the chance to talk to a finance person, I tell them that to their face in a kind way.
Well, I think, you know, in Marxist terms, what I think we're moving around is the cannibalization of use value by exchange value. And so all use values are now subject to the terms of exchange. I will say, I do think Peter Sullivan and that thing about being a rocket scientist, that feels actually now, looking back, like a part of the periodness of this film. Because rocket scientists now will go work for SpaceX. And these,
yeah,
even at their largest,
yeah,
you know, the major banks, Goldman, whether they took consumer deposits or not, you know, JP Morgan, all the people that were involved in TARP, I mean, they're tiny compared to the Mag 7 today. You know, Apple, wow. Amazon, NVIDIA, Tesla. I mean, those companies are way bigger than these banks ever were. And they do produce something, but I think there are similar contradictions at work. I mean, maybe Facebook is the most obvious of this, where it's like,
yeah,
they're pretty bad for the Commonwealth when you think about it in a lot of ways. But that actually, I do think, has changed since the movie came out. I think finance has become less aspirational, and tech has become where it's, you know, where those kinds of people are going, even though, again, tech relies on the farming or the mining of certain kinds of precious metals, you know, large scale factory work in China and other parts of the world. So I don't think it's better in that way. But that feels very much of the period to me, in addition to some of the fashion choices and the phones. No one has a smartphone, right? They have. That's another kind of interesting piece of it. I would say, just to do maybe a little Marxist lightning round, the other interesting thing is the extension of the working day to its absolute limits. I mean, here we see, you know, all the barriers to work being completely overridden. You know, Sam's, you know, whatever on the FDR drive, and they're like, hey, you got to get back in here, and turns around. They're at the office for 36 hours. It's like just non-stop. I mean, I got to say, I kind of love that Jeremy Irons' character comes in the middle of the night in helicopter, and then we see him eating a steak and, you know, drinking burgundy at 5 o'clock. He probably hasn't eaten all day. You know, he's kind of like Cormac McCarthy's The Judge. It's like he'll dance. He will never die. He will be here. Or like Robert Duvall in Apocalypse Now. You know, the guy didn't have a scratch on him throughout the whole Vietnam War. That's the kind of character vibe I get there.
Yeah, he's elemental.
Yeah.
I definitely thought he was the strongest. In terms of performance, I will say I think Kevin Spacey was just deeply miscast. I just don't, I just don't think he, to me, I think he played, it was odd because I feel like he really sings when he plays the Jeremy Irons character. Like, I think he's very good at, like, fucking evil, but also just, like, the most powerful man in the room, other than American Beauty. But I don't know, it just, I felt like, for me, the script was the strongest, and I thought some of the performances just were miscast, and I wondered what, I don't know, your thoughts were on that, but I thought that, yeah, there was just, I felt like it was hard to, like, his character was written to, I think, hold that, the, if there was any kind of moral quandary or complexity or paradox. And I just didn't really think he fully got it.
That's funny. I really think all of the performance, and I think all the performances in this are pretty stellar, especially Jeremy Irons. Jeremy Irons just comes in for like 20 minutes and just kills it. Just is absolutely on fire the entire time. I felt a little bit of that that tension with the Spacey character, not with his performance, but in the ways they did try to humanize him and did try to imbue him with a little bit more, I don't know, moral scruples than the other characters, because we're introduced to him and he's sad because his dog has just died, which is sad. And,
but
you
thought
know,
that was the writing.
It was the writing.
Did
but
that more than...
I this is what it was. I had a hard time buying that a man in his position, the guy running the trading floor would have this many moral reservations about these things. I feel like if in real life, if this guy has gotten to this point in his career, he's just like, yeah, you're right. Fuck all these people. Let's move these toxic assets. So, but maybe I just don't know people in that world that well. But that was the kind of thing that I was like, I really feel like they're trying to humanize him, and I don't need really anyone in this movie to be humanized.
Well, I guess I needed some clarity. Maybe you both can help me. I needed clarity on, like, I got that I was like, he feels like he's like, I'm with the firm. I'm like, I get it. But I wasn't fully sure what he was feeling hesitant about. Maybe you can help clarify. And maybe that was just finance terminal. But, like, I wasn't sure. Was it that he was like, I know we're going to fuck over the whole market? In which case, I was also with you, Frank. I was like, it's hard for me to believe he hasn't. And maybe that's just because you're like, we can see it coming a mile, like, you know.
I mean, there's a reputational thing. He's about to absolutely tarnish his own and the firm's reputation. So,
and all the people who work for
him. And all the people who work for him.
That made sense when he's like, you're never going to be able to get a job. But he had just fired all these people. So it was also hard to be like, I feel like you fire people every day.
Exactly. That's where I felt like some of those
people's lives daily.
Some of those inconsistencies came in.
Yeah, I do think the reputational risk is major, which is very different from firing. I mean, firing is part of the business. And I think actually it's great that we start off and we see people getting laid off.
Yeah.
And Susan Blackwell, absolutely, who plays one of the people laid off, she has these amazing hand gestures that Brian Koppelman pointed out on another podcast about this film. And so I thought that was just like fantastic. But I do think that's why it's not just firing, but he's like, these are consequences for your careers. You know, and he has this kind of lame speech when they start the day, you know, where he's like, we at the end, you know, he's like, well, we must believe our powers have been used, you know, for the greater good. And I think you get a sense that he's kind of lying there, or he's unsure about it in the moment. But I do think he's worried about, yeah, what's going to happen to the firm. I mean, I think he just thinks Told is wrong to some extent, that they don't have to do this. This is going to wreck the whole thing. Maybe by the end of the day, he has a different opinion, but he has to do it. It's for the firm. You know, he's ready to do it. I do think what would have been interesting is to find some way in the script, which I think is pretty fantastic, by the way, especially for something on such a tight timeline. Also, they shot it in 17 days, which is incredible. And J.C. Chandler said he wrote it in 4. So, I mean, it's like,
okay,
pretty impressive. But if there had been some way for him to actualize that risk, I mean, if he had had to fire Will, you know, someone we've seen him invest in to go for bat for, that I think could have brought some of that home. I don't think that would have been the right move necessarily, but it is a little abstract, I would say, or you have to infer what he cares about in that
way.
Yeah,
there was a lot of needing to abstract and infer things, which I don't know. I don't know if that's just because I had to work harder as an audience, which I'm kind of very for. Like, I don't know if I'm battling my own things that I don't like about generally an American audience watching films anyway. Like, I don't know. Because part of me is like, I love that I have to probably watch this a few times to grasp it. And it was so detached for me. Like, there wasn't I didn't have an emotional viewing. Did you both feel emotional at times? Like, to me, it was very intellectual.
No, I'm not emotionally compelled by any of these characters. I don't really care about any of them. I love dramas where high powered people are just, you know, spitting jargon at one another and trying to cut each other down. And, has a very like Glengarry Glenn Ross kind of, you know, that's sort of like terse, like we're going at each other's throats and there's quippy dialogue and these funny zipper one liners. I just love shit like that. So as much as I detest finance people, I love watching movies about finance people. That's a contradiction about me.
I don't know if I was emotionally invested in the way, you know, it's not Sophie's choice by any means, but maybe
Sam's
it works.
Choice.
it works more in my Enderkin system. I think the emotional high point for me is actually when they're in the top of the building, which is at One Penn Plaza, where I took my GRE years after I saw the film.
Oh, wow.
And they're sitting up there and Will, you know, kind of climbs on the railing. He's like, you know, most people when they're up here, it's not the fear of falling. It's the fear that they might jump. And they're kind of like, get down, get down. Then he gets down. He's like, whew, it's like, not today. You know,
that freaked me out. I did feel something there.
That sense of like, I'm going to maybe contemplate this horrific suicide in order to just kind of like return me to reality. That was like pretty deep. And I think there is that kind of thrill that you're looking for in those kinds of occupations, because on the day to day, the things you're dealing with are just drudgery. I mean, they're
what a profound line and like moment in this film where I think even like, as you said that, I was like, it is a statement on capitalism, because I think a lot of this is about us inside of this system. And the idea that it's less scary, like the really scary thing is that we're capable of such self-destruction. I love those existential moments, but like the idea that you are there, like, I mean, it's as small as if I sit in a theater, I'm like, I could stand up and scream. Just that idea of like, I could do something, I can participate. And like, the fact is we do. And I think a lot of this film has clues into that, as like, we're all participants in this system. And it is pretty wild to see that it's just one dude at the top, that like all these people actually could have come together. Maybe like there's no thought of even just coming together. There's no, you know, but the potential, which again, capital ends here, is like there is so much radical potential when you realize the concentration of power and wealth. While that seems really scary and there's a lot there, it is, we have like the power of numbers, but that we are all kind of actively in some ways participating in jumping. Like we jump every day, like all of these characters take the jump. Sam takes the jump, like they all do. They're like, I want out, but then I need the money.
But of course, at the same time, they're, you know, protected. I think that's the fantasy of the capitalist firm, certainly in the United States post 2008, that there is some kind of it is socialized. The losses are socialized. I mean, this is a basic tenet, I think, of kind of modern Bernie Sanders-ish movement. And it's the gains that are privatized. Mm. But these banks now know that they will be covered. And I mean, there is some loss. Like when Silicon Valley Bank, you know, basically had a run, the depositors were made whole and the investors lost their money. So, you know, I'm sure someone could listen to what I just said and say, well, it's not really true. But And that was the criticism of TARP and the other responses was and I, warranted was that the banks were made whole and in regular homeowners. I mean, I think there was like $40 billion-ish set aside for individual households who are struggling with mortgage payment and other needs. And that was like a tenth of the $400 billion or so aid that went out, you know. So I don't know. But there is that kind of thrill of risking it all. That is somehow a part of wanting to do that job. But I think in reality, that's not the case. It is very supported and protected. There is a backstop. The Treasury has made it very clear that they will come in and save your ass for the most part, especially when you're at a certain size. So, I mean, that I'll just say really quickly, we earlier talked about that monologue that Will Emerson has, you know, the things get really fair really fast. If I take my hand off the the scales, everything changes. Well, that's actually true for workers. You know, that's why the strike is so effective.
Right.
Is that when the workers withhold their labor, right, everything does come to a stop. So I think Will is completely correct from the standpoint of the capitalist. But I just think in reality, what Marx shows is that that's actually true for the worker. It just comes at a massive cost. Mm. And that's why people make it so hard to strike, to associate all these other things that Marx and we on the left talk about and think about.
Well, and both of those moments are Will trying to demonstrate or prove to himself or justify why he is even doing this job to begin with, which is clearly providing him no sort of like spiritual nourishment, is an immensely alienating occupation because, again, you're not producing anything. You're only making money for rich people. So when the only thing that you have that is actually like a salve on your on that justifies all of your life choices, it's the only thing can be money, and money can only give you so much. So in both of those scenes, he's like he's so severely alienated. He's just reaching to feel something or to feel like his role actually matters in the world, like he's actually helping people or he has influence on people or like, you know, I'm in this position for a reason.
Can I say one thing about the Kevin Spacey dog ending?
Yes.
I've gone back and forth about this. I like that it's his ex-wife that he goes to the house, so they're not married. That I think is good. Obviously, I mentioned the dog at the end. There's some sense like time and death are coming for us all, and he can't really grieve except by the dog. But it also has never sat completely well with me. It seems like a kind of forced metaphor. My one like speculative revision to this, you know, kind of like people who want to take the rat out at the end of The Departed, is that the dog dies. I like that. I like that he misses the dog's death. But then I think he should call his son. And because there's this little moment between him and Zachary Quinto, they're outside.
Yeah.
And Zachary Quinto says, "I think I know your son. He's a nice guy." And Kevin Spacey's like, "Well, I guess you could say worse things about someone." Zachary Quinto says something like, "Well, does he know what's about to happen?" And you kind of see Kevin Spacey maybe think, you know, I mean, he can't call him. It'd be insider trading. He can't tell him. And there's something to me that could be a really good connection as opposed to introducing the ex-wife at the end.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. Yeah, I want to see that ending.
Far from me to give notes to a film that's been extremely successful, but thinking about
it
over time.
Well, that's lucky for you. That's what we do on here.
And Dave, a good note is a good note, and that was a good note.
But yeah, that ending is always kind of sad, even though I like that we meet Kevin Spacey and he's like, "My dog is dying. I'm spending $1,000 a day just to keep her alive." You know, it's kind of a great, you know, rich person kind of thing. I'm sure he is spending $1,000 a day. It's expensive to take care of your pet.
All right, David. So this is the point in the episode where we give awards to this movie. You've said you've listened to episodes. So you know how this works. We have three awards. The first award is Best Politics. This goes to the character with the best politics in the movie.
See, it's a tough one. I guess I would go with Zachary Quinto. I mean, he kind of sees the risk. He understands that this is going to affect people. This is a very low bar to clear, but I guess he's got to be it. My other kind of tongue-in-cheek answer is the woman who does the night cleaning, who's in the elevator, stuck with Simon Baker.
One normal person representing the normal world.
Yeah. Just standing straight ahead. It's a great shot and a great scene, but I guess you got to give it to Peter Salvin.
Peter, or maybe the Stanley Tucci character, slightly? Rivka's shaking her head, not really.
I mean, I don't know. No, I mean, they all, like, I feel like they just, like, luck out on Best Politics here. They're just, like, it's accidental best politics.
Yeah, it's best politics by default. It's not, no one actually displayed. Although that little monologue Stanley Tucci has about building the bridge, I thought that was very sweet. Because that was an example of him, at least the way I read it, was him saying, you know, in my former career, I did a thing that actually mattered to people. I made a thing. I produced a thing. And actual people used it. I wasn't, my whole job wasn't just making money for people who already have money. So
yeah, but he maybe was getting the closest to sort of like being able to see big picture. But I thought, you know, one of the best parts of this film is that it really is like it doesn't fall into finding one demonizing person or one person better, because it is like the system pulls everyone back in. And even though he has that realization, he does have this fucking howl, you know, he's too deep in. So he comes back. He's like, I don't have a choice.
Yeah. I did love that line at the end when him and Demi Moore are talking about what their packages are going to be. And she's like, I can't believe they dragged you back here for this. And he said, well, I am going to be making $176,000 an hour. So, you know, it wasn't really a choice. And she says, yeah, it never is. And I thought that the way that they just showed how financial incentive, how they just choke these people with money to just get them to do anything. They're like, Demi Moore is like, I told you guys you were wrong. They're like, well, how about a bajillion dollars? She's like, you're right. I'll shut up. I'll shut up and I'll take this to my grave.
Our next award is Worst Politics, goes to the character with the worst politics in the movie. I mean, that feels a little clearer. Top dog, right?
Yeah, the Jeremy Irons. Tolda is the character's name?
Told, I think. Just Told. Yeah, the D at the end.
Oh, just Told? His name is Told?
I told you so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to imagine the CEO. I mean, he espouses some pretty horrendous politics. I don't know if there's like...
that speech at the end is pretty...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the worst it gets, I think. Did you have anyone else? Any other contenders?
Yeah. No, I mean, again, I've talked about why I think Will Emerson's politics are wrong, even though it's the way the capitalists make sense of the world. I mean, maybe I give it his whole just because he's so eloquent about it at the end. So I also kind of despise Seth's little, you know, asking everyone how much money they make and things like that. So it's kind of three iterations of the same bad politic. Oh, that's
so funny. See, I really related to Seth doing that because I just felt like it's so like, I don't know. It felt like, to me, it felt the closest to normal of like people being like, so how much, like we're here for the money, right? It was the most honest, right? Like they're all thinking it. But then everyone learns to, and he's just like, but how much money do you make? Anyways, he'd be very happy to be nominated alongside. Like, he'd be thrilled.
Seth has no politics whatsoever. He has barely any opinions other than I want to make money.
I thought of another award. Maybe we'll add this, Frank.
Okay.
But who most likely to be radicalized?
Mm. Ooh, that's a good one. Let's do that. Let's do that instead of...
Because I feel like it could be Seth.
For sure.
In some ways, because he's younger, maybe. And because he's the most... He gets... Like, I feel like that moment of the crying in the bathroom... That's his radical lie. Either he's going to go and be like the worst dude. I feel like this is his, like, he could either be radicalized, be like, fuck this place, or be like, I'm going to be told no matter what it takes.
I feel like Demi Moore could be a Sheryl Sandberg, Hillary Clinton Democrat. I don't know about radical, but I could see her, you know, spending a lot of time on various causes, you know, having a lean in book group.
1,000%.
Something like that.
Yeah.
After
a media company. Wow.
Yes. Yeah. Radical is hard. Because the problem with Zachary Quinto as a candidate is that I just feel like he's on the fast track. Like he'll get here and then he'll work for some startup in 2 years and he's like on the train, you know, I mean, he's going to be taken care of.
Yeah. I thought he was a little underwritten, to be honest, just like slightly, if we're going to give any more, like, you know, I know there was a lot to get in, but
I thought he was more articulate than a lot of people who do quantitative jobs primarily. He might even be like, and he's also like very good looking for a guy.
And never had a moment where you'd be like, you started this whole thing. They didn't really give him any scenes where you really had that moral quant or like, you're like, how do you feel about this? Like we never really, he was just kind of always like, guess I solved it. Guess I'm getting a promotion.
See, maybe it was more in Quinto's performance, but I felt like he had a moral opinion about everything. And that's what I was kind of getting at before was that he's like, look, I'm very, very smart and I understand how the world works. So I'm here to make money. But it didn't feel, it felt like he had processed that. And again, I think it's just a performance, but I felt like there's maybe hope for radicalization for his character. Like he knows enough, he's smart enough that maybe at some point, maybe by Trump's election or the pandemic, he's like, oh, this is all fucked. Like, I've wasted the last 15 years of my life. I need to, like, go work for, you know, an NGO or something.
Fascinating. So we had Seth and Peter up for potential radicalized. Seth has been nominated twice. I think Seth would be happy about this award ceremony.
Yeah, I don't think there's any hope for radicalization for anyone in this C-suite. All of those people are, they're gone. They're absolutely gone.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, this was such a fantastic conversation, David. Thank you so much. Before we let you go, we love to discuss with our guests how they, as artists, as people, strive to practice values, whatever values they are, anti-capitalist values in their daily lives.
I'll just talk about the reading group a little bit more. I know Alex talked about it in a previous episode, but Rivka and I were in a reading group of Capital. It was 12 weeks. We have our final kind of reflections session coming up. And I just think political education and study are important. And it's great to read the text by yourself. That I've had great experiences with different kinds of anti-capitalist texts and even capitalist texts. You know, understanding the other side can be good. But really the act of getting together and discussing and questioning and finding out how to share knowledge has been really fantastic. And I've especially loved being with a group of people who are theater artists and workers and very creative, different kinds of ways, actors, producers, in addition to other jobs. Because I actually found out, I haven't said this, Rivka, but there was a parallel Marx reading group of theater scholars that I found out about. Because I'm a sometime ne'er-do-well academic scholar. And there was one of my colleagues at NYU was like, I'm also in a Marxist reading group.
Oh, damn.
So I have these fantasies that the two would come together. But I was like, yeah, it's me, a director, and about eight actors. It's like the most in-shape Marxist reading group you will ever find. So with the best like vocal tonality, everyone sounds great. Yeah, I highly encourage people to study. You know, I wish I had done it earlier in my life.
Same.
And maybe we'll do another book. And this podcast is
wonderful.
You know, political education. I feel like you guys don't shy away from the term propaganda either. So it's great.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you. I love any opportunity to revisit this movie about finance people that I hate but love to watch. So thank you.
Love.
can I ask, did we skip the character spinoff award? I had something written down for that.
We can do it really quick.
We can throw
I think
it in
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, let's do it.
All right. So we'll maybe add the radicalization in long term, but our last award is best supporting character / spinoff. Goes to your favorite supporting character and maybe a spinoff that they would appear in.
Okay, there is an unnamed, unspeaking role played by the actress Maria Dizia, where she leads them into the conference room before Tol is there, and she has the most incredible stare, and she sits down perfectly. She's an amazing actor. One of the reasons why you can tell this film was cast by Telsey, because they have just a bunch of great New York actors. But I want to know her. I mean, she seems like the chief of staff who's like buried some deep, dark secrets. And I also just think
she's like,
actress.
Told's as executive assistant, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's unclear exactly
something
what she
like
is.
That? But, oh, totally. I'm glad you mentioned that.
I think
like
she's fantastic.
The character Zoe Winters plays in Succession, I feel like there's also like potential for
Yes.
There's a lot that, I'm with you. I would love to. And she's one of my favorite actresses. So I would love to see that. I wonder what that film would be called.
Taking Names.
Taking Names is a good one. And you know what? All this conversation about Seth, I would watch more Seth. I want to see where Seth goes after this. I came in thinking that he was a bullshit character that we didn't need it, and now I realized he was actually the protagonist of this whole movie. So Seth's radicalization.
Maybe he's still in Murray Hill on Raya, you know, just trying to find love in a hopeless place, baby.
Or he starts Occupy.
Or he goes the other direction. Yeah. He's a Bernie bro.
Yeah. He's there in Zuccotti Park. Like, I was there, man. I was there on the top floor. I saw it all go down. Let's all go to the lobby. Thank you all so much for listening. Make sure to follow us on Instagram and TikTok. And if you want to support this show and get access to our Patreon episodes, the link is in the episode description in your podcast player or at mvcpod.com.
For next week, we'll be watching the 2014 jazz drama Whiplash.
Whoopsh. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.